and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, we wrap up testimony from Michael Cohen, the former attorney for President Trump. Next, Trump advisor Jared Kushner is finishing his Middle East trip, where he's trying to sell the so-called deal of the century that he hopes to broker between Israel and the Palestinians, while the UN Human Rights Council has filed a report today with evidence of Israeli war crimes against Palestinian protesters. Then, our regular segment, Veterans for Peace, concentrates on Venezuela and Korea. And then we cover the race to militarize space. Finally, Iranian President Rouhani rejected his foreign minister's resignation earlier in the week. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Rona McDaniel, chair of the Republican National Committee, sought to discourage potential primary challengers to President Trump today, saying, quote, "They have the right to jump in and lose. That's fine. They'll lose horribly," unquote. Former Ohio Governor John Kasich and current Maryland Governor Larry Hogan are rumored to be considering a primary challenge. Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido met with European Union ambassadors to Brazil, publicly with the Brazilian foreign minister, and then privately with right-wing Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. Despite Brazil recognizing Guaido as the leader of Venezuela, he will not receive the formal honors that foreign dignitaries traditionally get. Guaido will meet with Paraguay's President Mario Abdo tomorrow. State Department data was released today showing that 37,000 visas were denied in 2018 due to President Trump's travel ban. This had an outsized effect on people applying for visas from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen, where the number of visas was 80% lower than in 2016, the last year with no travel ban. More than 15,000 immigrant visas were denied, and more than 21,000 visas for tourism, business, visits to family, medical procedures, or other short-term reasons were denied. Former Maine Governor Paul LePage today said in reference to a bill that would abolish the Electoral College, quote, "What would happen if they do what they say they're going to do is white people will not have anything to say. It's only going to be the minorities that would elect. It would be California, Texas, Florida. We're going to be forgotten people," unquote, apparently referencing white people. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Michael Cohen's testimony. Michael Cohen, President Trump's longtime personal attorney and fixer, testified on Capitol Hill, this was yesterday, saying that the president was a liar, a con man, and a racist, and that those around him had traded their own integrity for proximity to power. Expectedly, the president exploded on Twitter despite being busy with his summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Cohen is due to report to prison on a myriad of felony charges in the next few weeks, which his opponents cite as reason to disbelieve his testimony. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of the book The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
Dan, it's funny to me that both sides yesterday at the conclusion of this long day of testimony, both sides said that Michael Cohen was a liar. Now, I understand that the Republicans want to discredit him because he's trying to discredit the president. But why would the Democrats accuse him of being a liar as well?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, because he seems to be helping them quite a bit with his testimony. So to the extent he's a liar, it kind of undoes that. But, you know, I mean, let's face it, both parties try to have things both ways. You know, even Trump was interesting in that he said that Cohen lied about everything except one thing. And that was that Cohen said he didn't have evidence, didn't see any evidence of Trump collusion with Russia. So, of course, Trump saw that as a win, but everything else was a lie. So everyone's trying to get out of this what they want out of it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, the phenomenon that we've seen repeated over and over again is that people who, were once close to Donald Trump or to the Trump administration, but then for whatever reason, there's a falling out. And then the official who, you know, prior to that was demonized, maybe rightly so, is sort of embraced by the quote unquote resistance. So, I mean, that happened to James Comey, of course. Anybody who sort of has this following, Mattis, right? General Mattis, the former Secretary of Defense. And now a character like Michael Cohen is kind of, it seems like he's getting the same treatment to a certain extent.
Yeah, well, again, yeah, he's now the liberal hero for the most part. You know, I'll say I did hear some of the testimony. He comes across as contrite and, you know, probably truthful about most things he said. I mean, and none are particularly surprising given what we already know about Trump. And so, yeah, I think Cohen is now the witness for the prosecution, the Democrats being the prosecutors in all of this, who, you know, may try to impeach Trump. And so, yeah, I think Cohen, you know, may end up salvaging his reputation. Meanwhile, I mean, what I thought was also interesting, though, is that as, you know, they were having this hearing, of course, there were peace talks with North Korea and Vietnam that are very important. And it seemed to me that the media almost invariably wanted them to fail and were glad when they did, which is another interesting piece to all this.
I want to read to you the president's tweet at the end of the day yesterday. It was not about North Korea. It was about Michael Cohen. He says, "Michael Cohen was one of many lawyers who represented me, unfortunately. He had also other clients. He was just disbarred by the state Supreme Court for lying and fraud. He did bad things unrelated to Trump. He is lying in order to reduce his prison time. Using Crooked's lawyer!" Exclamation point, apparently referencing Hillary Clinton. Is any of that untrue?
Probably it's not untrue. Again, you know, Cohen, first of all, he's as much of a manipulator as Trump is. He's as much of a liar as Trump is. We know this. That's why he's going to jail. Did he therefore, you know, give testimony that was skewed or even not true in order to get a better deal? I have no doubt that that's true. So, yeah, I mean, again, it's the pot calling the kettle black, but, you know, they're both a pot and a kettle. I mean, none of us dispute that.
And speaking of the pot and the kettle, Dan, yesterday's testimony was, if you read the major papers, explosive. But when you come right down to it, I don't think that Cohen said anything that he hasn't already said in other venues. Did you get anything new out of this testimony?
So, you know, really, I don't think we heard anything new of substance, you know. Again, it's interesting that he admitted he didn't see any evidence of collusion. That's interesting. He talked about the hush money being paid, which, again, is not new. What was new and kind of interesting was that he decided to go on a monologue attacking Trump's political policies, you know, the shutdown over the wall, for example. And Trump, I guess, disparaging veterans and various things. So he really went off script, which, you know, seemed to be, you know, should have been focused on Trump's misdeeds and frauds and whatnot, really just to attack him as a president. And I found that interesting. But again, people seem to really eat that up, even though, again, why should we care what Cohen thinks about those things? I don't know. But that was the interesting part to me.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. I agree. And it shows, I mean, how completely political this whole thing is. I mean, it's not some, you know, impartial judicial probe. But, you know, the other piece that I thought was kind of interesting, and this is the kind of stuff that I'm more inclined to believe is true, are just sort of the personal anecdotes about Donald Trump. Now it's not like going to be a shock to anybody, like, oh, wow, Donald Trump has racist attitudes towards black people, for instance, or you know, oh, wow, Donald Trump threatens and intimidates people who might embarrass him, right? But, I mean, I think some of that stuff, like, is actually believable. You know, like the thing about the transcripts and SAT scores from the schools that he went to. Some of that stuff, I think, is true. And then more substantively, and I think that the line of questioning pursued by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was probably the one that focused on this more, is sort of his business dealings in New York City, too, and, you know, the different tactics that he used to get his way and to make money. There is some of that in there, but again, that's kind of all besides the point when we consider that what's theoretically driving this is the idea that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia during the 2016 election.
Yes, and well, in the exactly. So, and again, that's the one piece he seems to say he has no evidence of, you know, which is probably probative of something. That is to say, he probably should know of such evidence if it existed, and he's saying it doesn't exist. So that's very interesting. Meanwhile, at least what I was hearing after the hearing was, at least the opinion was, the general opinion was, that the Democrats would not move to impeach Trump over the hush money issues, which is really the stuff that Cohen has on him. So it doesn't sound like what Cohen has testified to is going to really help the Democrats in efforts to impeach Trump. They seem to feel like they need more, you know. So this was all kind of theater, really. It was political in the sense that the goal, of course, was to undermine Trump's presidency. And, you know, it probably did that to some extent. And again, I do find it interesting that they decided to do this when Trump was in Vietnam trying to broker a peace deal with North Korea, almost as if they would like to undermine that as well. And I think they would. I mean, again, that's the other troubling piece to all this, that what one takes away from all this is that it seems that there's almost unanimity in the desire not to have peace with North Korea. And that's more troubling to me than anything that Cohen said, to be honest.
Dan, we've got 1 minute left. Tell us if we've seen the last of Michael Cohen. Do you think that he's had his say and he's going to prison to live unhappily ever after? Or is he an integral part of this effort to take down Donald Trump?
Well, it's a very good question. My gut opinion is we've probably seen virtually the last of him. I don't think he has much more to add. Again, no one thinks this is enough to impeach Trump over, so I think he may quietly go away to prison, though. You know, hey, we saw Elliot Abrams arise from nowhere, so God knows whether Cohen may.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Well, we'll leave it there. We were joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. Dan's a human rights and labor lawyer who's the author of the book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Dan, thanks for joining us. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
President Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is finishing up a visit through the Middle East to publicize an Israeli-Palestinian peace plan, which the White House is calling the deal of the century. Meanwhile, the United Nations released a report saying that, quote, the commission found reasonable grounds to believe that the use of live ammunition by Israeli security forces against demonstrators was unlawful, unquote. We're joined from Washington by Ariel Gold. She's a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. Ariel, welcome back.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Ariel, the deal of the century, I've been hearing this phrase for many months now, and I'm not seeing any deal. Are you?
I don't expect to see a deal. I expect to see a demand. And we have seen how blindly the Trump administration supports Israel's system of occupation and apartheid, and how much disrespect they have for Palestinian rights. So there's really not much we can expect from this deal.
There's been a number of efforts over the years to broker, you know, like John was saying, quote unquote, the deal of the century. You know, the most prominent one was probably the Oslo Accords in the early 1990s. There's also in the early 2000s, the Arab Peace Initiative. But none of that has actually succeeded in restoring rights to the Palestinian people. I mean, why is that? Why have negotiations sort of always hit this dead end?
Well, because there's this assumption that these are two equal sides, and these absolutely are not two equal sides. This is occupier and occupied, oppressor and oppressed. And when we're looking at this particular deal, I think we have to take into account as well that Kushner just met with Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, to gather support from him for this deal. We are talking about a war criminal, mass murderer who has created the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet in Yemen, who used a bone saw to cut up a journalist. And he is supposed to be the great U.S. partner for the deal of the century to bring human rights to Palestinians?
Yeah, and you know, I want to talk to about the Palestinians, actually, because the Palestinians said early on at the first announcement of this so-called deal of the century that they weren't even going to discuss it, because what it was just the U.S. and Israeli position imposed on them. Has there been any change at all among the Palestinians to sit with Jared Kushner and negotiate this thing?
Well, why would Palestinians have any hope that this is an honest process with them when the U.S. unilaterally moved our embassy to Jerusalem just throwing mud in the face of international law and Palestinian rights. So, you know, this is an absurd situation. And I really commend the Palestinian Authority in this case for saying, we're not going to have this ridiculous conversation. What we know so far of this deal, which, you know, we don't know much, but what we do know is that supposedly it's going to be basically what we would call economic peace, not peace and justice, but money coming into the West Bank and Gaza, largely from Saudi Arabia. So that's this reason that, you know, Kushner just met, or part of the reason with MBS. Now, back when the U.S. embassy was moved, Palestinians burned pictures of MBS and, you know, said clearly, this is not an ally of ours. And MBS's statement around Palestine was that Palestinians should, quote, shut up and accept what they're given.
When you sort of look at the bigger picture regionally, you know, of course, there's no formal diplomatic relations between Israel on the one hand and Saudi Arabia and its allied Gulf states on the other. But they do have one very strong and central common strategic interest. And that's mutual hostility towards Iran, right? And of course, that's something that the Trump administration shares. I mean, do you think that this effort to sort of bring on board these Gulf monarchies, these highly repressive Gulf monarchies on board with this, you know, peace plan, quote unquote, peace plan, could it be at least partially motivated by this desire to have an anti-Iran front in the region?
Absolutely. And this isn't the only instance that we've seen of this. So after the Poland summit, that, you know, was really an anti-Iran summit, Netanyahu came away from that bragging, I've built a coalition. And he actually tweeted out to go to war with Iran and then had to delete that tweet and try to walk it back. I built a Middle East coalition. So this has been brewing for a while. And there's also other various rumors about Israel selling intelligence mechanisms to Saudi Arabia and other things that we see of this budding and growing friendship between two repressive regimes.
Well, that's something really that people in general are not talking about. And it's an important point, is that all of a sudden we've seen what amounts to a de facto military alliance between the Saudis and Emiratis and the Israelis. 20 years ago, an Arab would have laughed at me if I had said that there was going to be this military alliance between these three countries. But that's the truth. And it's because they hate and they fear Iran. Even if there is no direct Iranian threat, they still want to cooperate with each other to develop weapons, perhaps even nuclear weapons, as we read recently, relative to the Saudis. And this is to the exclusion of everything else, including a peace deal.
Well, and I would also say it's because, very simply, military powers and financial gain from the military and empires of repression and military like each other. I mean, we see this right now in the, you know, friendship between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. You know, there are alliances that come along these lines, and we're seeing it now with Israel and Saudi Arabia.
Let's turn to this new report that was issued by the United Nations. It's regarding the Great March of Return protests that have been going on for almost 1 year now, primarily along the border between the Gaza Strip and Israel. Hundreds of people have been killed, thousands of people shot by Israeli snipers. And this UN report reaches some damning conclusions. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. Well, of the 189 people that were killed, the United Nations said 183 of them were shot with live ammunition, and this included 35 children, 3 health workers, and 2 journalists. Over 6,000 people have been wounded by the live ammunition. And again, these include children and medics and journalists. And so, you know, the UN came to the very logical conclusion that Israel may have committed war crimes. You know, one of the most interesting things here, so Israel, of course, then hit back, accusing the UN of being biased against Israel. One of the most interesting things here that we're seeing in terms of bias is that the New York Times today, while they did write an article on this report, they did not publish it in their print edition. Instead, in their print edition, they published an article about the response by Israelis to the investigation and coming indictment of Netanyahu.
Yeah, just stunning. There's an election coming up in Israel. It seems like the different political parties are racing to outdo themselves by being, you know, more right-wing, more nationalistic, more anti-Palestinian, their political orientation. Do you think that they'll seize on reports like this, you know, to strengthen this narrative that, well, Israel is isolated, it's under attack, it's being unjustly singled out by, you know, these international institutions? And how do you respond to that narrative?
Well, they constantly, you know, use that we're being attacked as a campaign promise. But Israel is absolutely singled out. They're singled out by the U.S. for diplomatic cover in the international community. They're singled out by the U.S. for $3.8 billion a year, more than anybody else, in military aid for ongoing support. And it's completely absurd to say that the UN singles them out. Israel has decided that they make their own rules, right? You know, the rest of the world has one opinion and they have their own. They've decided that whatever they do is moral, regardless of unarmed people who are killed, regardless of international opinion and condemnation or any of it. And the aspect in which they're correct is where what they build that on is, as long as we have the U.S. on our side. And with the Trump administration, more so than possibly ever before, they have the U.S. on their side.
Ariel, we have only 30 seconds left, but I want to tell you that there's breaking news coming from the Associated Press saying that the Israeli Attorney General has just announced corruption charges have been filed against Benjamin Netanyahu. We can talk again the next time about what effect this may have or may not have on Israeli elections. I'm sorry to say that we've run out of time to talk about it now, though.
Absolutely. And let's build that into the alliance with the Jewish KKK that Netanyahu has built.
Indeed. Indeed, we will. That's important. Well, we were joined from Washington by Ariel Gold. She's a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll come back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
It's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. We're joined every week from California by Jerry Condon. Jerry's a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, currently as national president of Veterans for Peace. Welcome back, Jerry.
Glad to be here with you. Thank you.
Jerry, the news is all about North Korea today, and the president is leaving Vietnam without a deal. There's a discrepancy now about exactly why there isn't a deal. The president said that the Koreans wanted complete sanctions relief. The Koreans now are saying that the North Koreans are saying that they were only asking for partial sanction relief. What's happening over there? And tell us about the point of view of peace groups that are active in that region.
Sure. Well, I don't know exactly what's happening over there, of course. I know it's a big disappointment because a lot of people believe this was a very unique window of opportunity here to at least sign a document that would finally end the Korean War. As you know, there's been an armistice, a temporary armistice in place for many years, and the war still really continues, including, of course, the economic war, which is apparently the big sticking point in the negotiations there. From hearing from people who are over there now, and when they saw John Bolton, the national security advisor and super hawk John Bolton at the table, they immediately were alarmed that there might be trouble because this guy's not about peace. Neither is national U.S. State Department head of the State Department Mike Pompeo. So you know their presence was considered a bad sign. And you know I think that North Koreans say they're only seeking partial sanctions relief. Trump said they wanted total sanctions relief for just closing down one, while their main nuclear testing site. And so, I don't know how Trump can pretend that he and Kim Jong-un are having a love fest and at the same time refuse to end U.S. economic warfare against the people of North Korea. So that, you know, they just want to keep the screws against these people all the time. They're obviously wanting a very one-sided unilateral thing in their own favor. And even the Democrats are are demanding the same, the top Democrats in the House of Representatives. So that's all very disappointing.
Yeah, and the economic warfare that you're talking about, it's referred to in the corporate media as sanctions, but I completely agree with you. I mean, it really is a form of warfare just through the mechanism of starvation when you really get down to it. I mean, why does North Korea want these sanctions lifted so badly? Why do they want an end to this economic warfare? I mean, what's the cost that it takes on the society?
Right, and it's not only, you know, limiting their economic development, possibly adding to hunger in North Korea. We don't know exactly the scope of that, because that gets greatly exaggerated at times, I think. But it's also limiting the ability of North Korea and South Korea to move ahead on some joint economic ventures that would bring them closer together. So it's a real setback. I know Veterans for Peace has been calling for some time for a peace treaty. We actually have something we put together called the People's Peace Treaty with North Korea that people can find on our website, veteransforpeace.org. And that was many months ago, and it was distributed on many different websites and platforms, and tens of thousands of people have signed that. You know, we think it's time for that war to be over, and for including the sanctions, of course. And there is some good news this week, a kind of counterpoint that we'll be seeing more about probably, and that is that there is a bill introduced in the House of Representatives this week by Representative Ro Khanna and several other, about 18, I think, mainly Democratic Congress people, that does call for a peace treaty ending the U.S. war with North Korea. So that's something we should look for and encourage people to encourage their Congress people to sign on to that.
Yeah, I'm looking at this, the People's Peace Treaty with North Korea. And again, that's on veteransforpeace.org. You can check it out there and sign it yourself. There's one part in the introduction to it. It reads, recalling that the United States currently possesses about 6,800 nuclear weapons and has threatened the use of nuclear weapons against North Korea in the past, including the most recent threat by the U.S. president in his terrifying speech to the United Nations to, quote, totally destroy North Korea. I mean, the way it's being presented in the media in the United States is that, well, there's this grave nuclear threat from North Korea. And, you know, the administration is trying to defuse that threat. Well, you know what? Maybe North Korea feels like they're under a nuclear threat as well.
They're both sides are threatening one another. And I think the U.S. has, of course, a lot more firepower to make those threats with. So, you know, I think that there's this illusion, perhaps, that somehow Trump is seriously pursuing peace in North Korea. And a lot of people in the peace movement are hopeful that that's the case and have been encouraging that process. So we don't want to totally rain on that parade. If there's any possibility for peace or movement towards peace, we support it. On the other hand, there's every indication that Trump and his cronies, Pompeo and Bolton, are asking, you know, virtually asking for a unilateral surrender on the part of North Korea. After all, they developed the nuclear weapons in order to defend themselves against an attack by the United States. And, you know, so what's the U.S. doing to denuclearize?
Yeah, literally nothing. Actually, we're upgrading. It's the opposite. Jerry, let's switch over to Venezuela now. There's been so much going on in Venezuela, not just in Venezuela, but along the border with both Brazil and Colombia. The Lima Group met this past week in Colombia. Although the Lima Group is inherently anti-Venezuelan, it was actually created to oppose President Maduro. They did come out and reject the military option. Does that give you any hope for either a negotiated settlement or for a de-escalation in the situation on the ground in Venezuela?
Yeah, it does. I mean, we can always hope. You know, the U.S. and Colombia staged this violent confrontation at the border last Saturday, and which they had a lot of announced ahead of time, had a lot of fanfare, had all kinds of international media on hand to witness. And they're kind of attempting to force their Trojan horse of so-called humanitarian aid across the border. But on that very same day, people were protesting against the attempted coup in Venezuela in nearly 150 cities in the U.S. and around the globe. And I'm happy to say that many chapters of Veterans for Peace were involved, you know, in New York, Miami, Minneapolis, Seattle, Portland, Oakland, Los Angeles, San Diego. I was actually in Tijuana, Mexico, at the invitation of our deported veterans chapter. And we had a terrific forum well attended on Friday night, and then a protest at the border wall on Saturday morning, along with the Central American asylum seekers. So I think that You know, the protests were much more successful than the show that was orchestrated by the U.S. at Venezuela's border with Colombia. And now it seems like apparently they were hoping that there'd be, you know, they staged the defection of a few low-level border guards and tried to make a big deal out of that. But they're really hoping for a more massive defection. And it's clear now that the Venezuelan military is going to back their government, as they should. So I think that the coup appears to have lost some steam, and now they're starting to look for some other options. Perhaps they're more open to negotiation. I know the Venezuelan government is actually saying we want to negotiate with Trump because he's the actual leader of the opposition. So we can take a little bit of hope. But on the other hand, we have to realize that this is a long-term project by the United States that's been trying to overthrow Venezuelan government for a long time, and they're not about to quit. They have promised pretty much, John, to overthrow the governments of Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. They've just boldly stated that, John Bolton's so-called troika of tyranny. So, you know, I think there's going to be a increasing shift towards more and more intervention and bold intervention, both overt and covert, in this hemisphere, and that the peace movement has to catch up with that as fast as we can.
And it's pretty remarkable how overtly ideological that push is, right? I mean, the Trump administration, kind of hoping to make it a theme of the 2020 presidential campaign, is presenting this as an offensive of, as Mike Pence described it, liberty versus socialism. Pretty amazing that the big allies of quote-unquote liberty in Latin America are the openly dictatorship-admiring president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, and the death squad-connected president of Colombia, Iván Duque.
Yeah, the old tried and true anti-communism is now it's anti-socialism. It's really interesting, too, because aside from trying to make socialism the issue, which I don't think is going to be a winning strategy, frankly, they're trying to make it an issue not only for their foreign policy in Latin America, but also for the elections here in the United States, trying to brand the Democrats as socialists, which is which were true, but it's not.
Okay, we will leave it there. That was the voice of Jerry Condon, who joined us from California. He is a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, currently as the national president of Veterans for Peace. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and we'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. Today, we continue our weekly segment dealing with the ongoing militarization of space. As the U.S. continues to withdraw from international arms treaties, will the weaponization and militarization of space bring the world closer to catastrophe? We're joined from Old Westbury, New York, by Professor Carl Grossman. He's a professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. He's also the author of 6 books and the host of a nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. Welcome back, Professor Grossman.
It's a pleasure.
So we're going to be continuing our ongoing conversation about Space Force, the new branch of the military that the Trump administration is in the process of setting up. Before we go into some of the latest developments, what is Space Force? Why should people be so concerned about it?
In Trump's own limited vocabulary, his words, what he declared last year was, quote, "It is not enough to merely have an American presence in space. We must have American dominance in space." And what he's been doing ever since has been promoting something which would be called the Space Force. And it would be a separate branch of the U.S. military, in addition to the Navy and the Army and so forth, a Space Force, which would bring war into the heavens. And it would fly in the face of the Outer Space Treaty, which 1967, which designates space as a global commons for peaceful purposes. He is pushing and pushing, and indeed, just in recent days, there's been even more developments. What a drive for this this new U.S. armed force. One of the developments is a big fight between officials in the and military folks in the state of Colorado and folks in the the state of Florida as to where this Space Force would be based. I'm just looking here at an article. This is from a Colorado Springs newspaper, The Gazette, February 25th, and it starts off, Colorado Springs is home to the bulk of the U.S. military space troops, with the U.S. Air Force Space Command, Army Space and Missile Defense Command at Peterson Air Force Base, and other units at Shriver Air Force Base, Cheyenne Mountain Air Force Station, Fort Carson. But that didn't slow Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis from making a pitch to put the Space Force in a new home. And the piece goes on, quoting this DeSantis, is saying that there's this space operation at Cape Canaveral, both a military and a ostensibly civilian operation. And this is just a tweet from Ron DeSantis. This is part of Florida's history, and it's a logical fit, a Space Force for our state. And just let me note that the piece goes on, the Space Force is still just a dream for Trump, who began crusading for the new service early in his presidency, and listen to this, continues to use the proposal as a crowd pleaser at his rallies. So, I mean, apparently Trump's move is to claim we got to build the wall. This is his big rally call. And the new addition is we got to have a Space Force to have U.S. dominance of space.
Yeah, I want to ask you to go back to that Ron DeSantis tweet. Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, is saying this is part of Florida's history. It's a logical fit for our state, referring to Cape Canaveral. So, you know, he's sort of making allusions to sort of, you know, the early days of U.S. space exploration in the, you know, 60s, 70s, you know, the sort of heroic and sort of like wonderful images that everybody has in mind. But I mean, it's really a distortion of history, because even though, of course, the U.S. space program was always tied to geopolitical objectives, geopolitical rivalries, I mean, what Ron DeSantis is referring to, I mean, those, they weren't putting weapons up into space. They weren't trying to put nuclear missiles in space or laser-based weapons. I mean, it's really not a part of the history, because this is something fundamentally different. This is about putting weapons of war in space.
Well, it hasn't happened up till now on the scale that Trump would have it. But we're talking decades of U.S. interest in weaponizing, not just militarizing space. There's a distinction that's made between militarizing space, having reconnaissance satellites and warfare direction from space. But the weaponization of space involves, well, what the U.S. has been talking about through the years, laser weapons, hypervelocity guns, particle beams, on battle platforms. And it begins with Project Paperclip. This is after World War II, when a bunch of Nazi scientists, including Werner von Braun, who was in charge of the V-2 rocket program for the Nazis, come over here, and they're based ultimately at the Redstone Army Arsenal in Alabama. And I've been there. I've seen it. In fact, in that town in Alabama, there's a whole museum which features Werner von Braun. And this was this big push led by the Nazis, but was embraced fully by the U.S. military to use space as a base for war. It didn't happen, but then came Star Wars of Ronald Reagan to have battle platforms and laser weapons and so forth. And again, an enormous push. It didn't happen. But under Trump, unless the Democrats have the nerve and the courage and the good sense to stop it, it easily could happen. And if it happens, if space is made a zone for war, there is no turning back, because other nations are not going to accept the U.S. having, and this is what Trump is talking about, dominance in space. Russia, China, you name the country, they'll be up in space too. And from a place which was to be used only for peaceful purposes under the Outer Space Treaty, which in fact was put together by the United States, the then Soviet Union, and the United Kingdom. I mean, it's been signed as an international treaty by 200 nations. From peaceful uses of space, we're going to go to military and war uses of space. A tragedy for mankind.
And now there's this sort of grotesque battle, to bring it back to that article where you're talking about this grotesque battle going on between the state government of Colorado and the state government of Florida about who will host the headquarters where this, you know, very, very dangerous thing for humanity is going to be based out of. There's another question, you know, as the Space Force moves from a concept which predates the Trump administration, we should say. I mean, there are, you know, many successive administrations that sought to, in one way or another, militarize space, but taken to a new level by the Trump administration through the order to create a separate space command, a space force. Another subsidiary issue as it gets into its operational phase is this idea that you flagged for us. Should the Space Force have its own acquisition corps, meaning a grouping, a department in charge of buying things? Wow, that sounds like some people are looking to make money off of this.
Well, that's been the name of the space game for many years in terms of the way it's developed. These, particularly Lockheed Martin, which is the world's largest weapons producer, and so they've been deeply in the middle of the U.S. ostensibly civilian space program and the military space program of the United States. And what you're mentioning is actually there's an article in Space News, is the big trade journal of the space program. And then one of its publications, Space News, is Military Space. And here's an article from February 26, not long ago, just a few days ago, which talks about, should the Space Force have its own acquisition corps? And a White House official, I'm reading the piece last week, commented that one of the benefits of having a separate space force is that it'll have its own specialized career track for buyers and program managers. And then the piece goes on about acquisition, and I'm sure a lot of the people will be doing acquisition will come from Lockheed Martin and Boeing. And in fact, the acting U.S. Defense Secretary formerly was with Boeing. I mean, it's been a revolving door in the United States for so many years in regards to contractors, military contractors, and those who are in the military, who are at the Pentagon. So, I mean, they're really getting ready for this thing. It's again, the issue isn't whether it should happen at this point. It's the issue of where it's going to happen, whether it's to be in Florida or whether it's to be in Colorado. And here you see the preparations for making money off a Space Force, developing a whole acquisition program. I mean, unless the Congress, and now that there's a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives, maybe it can be stopped there. It should be. It certainly should be stopped there. But as you say, this is not something that, I mean, we can point a finger, a big finger, at Trump and Reagan and the Nazis, but the Democrats in general in the United States over the decades, they've not been so hot on space issues. I mean, I'll tell a quick story. This is exactly 20 years ago. It was 1999. I'm in Geneva, Switzerland, and there's a vote in Geneva on expanding the Outer Space Treaty to forbid all weapons in space, not just weapons of mass destruction, as the Outer Space Treaty says, but all weapons. And this is an effort led by Canada, the neighbor of the U.S., Canada, Russia, and China. And I was actually speaking the day before the vote was to be held at the UN in Geneva. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom had a special day on space issues. I keynoted the day, and the U.S. ambassador to the UN in Geneva was there. And you could see as I was talking about, and again, this is 20 years ago. This is when the U.S. had a Democratic administration. And he was looking at me with such anger as I was going through, at that point, plans by the U.S. military, Vision for 2020, in fact, was a program. And this is 20 years ago, and 2020 would be in a year of having U.S. weaponry in space and so forth. In any case, as I'm walking along the street to go see what the vote's going to happen, what's going to happen at the vote, there, this U.S. ambassador, again, a Democrat working for a Democratic administration, sees me, and I'm a friendly fellow. I walk over to his side of the street, and we talk. And what, again, the Democrat says is that there was so much trouble in the United States when we fielded hundreds of thousands of troops during the Vietnam War. What we're looking at now is a different way to wage war. And a main one is our facility to use space. I mean, we're a leader in activities in space and from space. And he goes on and on and on, and ultimately votes against this, was the prevention of an outer space treaty, prevention of his arms race and outer space treaty, the Paris Treaty. He votes against it. Again, this is under a Democrat, and I just like to follow up with my conversation. What I said to him then, 20 years ago, I'm saying now that we may think, the U.S. may think, that we can have some kind of exclusive in space and we'll go up there and we'll from space dominate the planet below. But the world is not going to let that happen.
We're going to have to leave it right there. These are extremely important issues, and we'll pick up this conversation next week on Loud and Clear. We've been joined from Old Westbury, New York, by Professor Carl Grossman. He's a professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury, and he's the author of 6 books, host of a nationally aired televised program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif resigned earlier this week, just hours after meeting with an American peace delegation, and he apologized for what he called his shortcomings. But President Hassan Rouhani refused the resignation, and Zarif was back in the office 2 days later. What was behind this resignation? We're joined from Istanbul by Masoud Shajara. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Masoud, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Masoud, Al Jazeera reported last week that there was a final straw that led to this resignation, and that was the visit of Bashar al-Assad to Tehran. The foreign minister had no idea that Bashar al-Assad was visiting Tehran. He was completely cut out. This is not the first time this has happened. It's something like the 20th time this has happened, and he finally had had enough and resigned. Rouhani refused the resignation, and Zarif is back in his office. But what does that mean, to have a weak foreign minister? And who is it in the Iranian government that's trying to weaken him?
Well, this is really puzzling, because the reality is everyone who knows anything in Iran knows that Zarif has been extremely supported by Ayatollah Khomeini. And it really is a sort of exceptional circumstances. I haven't really seen in the past any official being supported, any foreign minister being supported as such as he has. And although sort of some of the policies when it comes to nuclear negotiation is not being, the policy might not be supported, but his action and indeed his deeds and his sincerity and the way that he has dealt with it, he's been extremely supported. And, you know, the only sort of criticism is not against him, but against the United States and the way United States is in a sort of situation that you can't really do an honest deal with the United States, especially with someone like Trump coming to power. So really, he's been supportive on that front. And in many ways, even the president is very supportive, but it seems to be someone or somehow there is a lack of sort of support when it comes to implementing the policies. I mean, everyone seems to be saying now that this was a shortcoming in the way that he was sort of not informed of the event, and he was excluded. And this, you know, it is being said that this is due to sort of shortcoming rather than sort of deliberate policy. I think it's very frustrating for Zarif, and also I feel that in some ways he probably was end of his tether, and the fact that he resigned at such a time which could give different signals vis-a-vis assets coming or vis-a-vis the sort of relationship and with Syria it was very damaging. And it seems quite clearly it had nothing to do with that. It's just a shortcoming, stupid some official not really doing their jobs properly. But nevertheless, I think it highlights that that he's not being valued. And indeed, there are people who are opposing him internally in Iranian structures.
One person who was invited to that meeting with Bashar al-Assad is Qasem Soleimani, a top commander of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. Do you think, you know, beyond the personalities, is there sort of an institutional clash between different, groupings in the Iranian government over who controls foreign policy?
Well, no, there isn't. I mean, the reality is that the foreign policy in Iran, we all know, it's controlled by Ayatollah Khamenei. And supreme leader, and that is sort of very clearly part of the constitution of Iran. But having said that, Soleimani was very quick to come out and say that Zarif has got priority on defining the foreign policy when it comes. And he actually was probably the first voice who came and said that. But I think also the way he resigned and the resignation, which the way that was sent to Rouhani, as you know, there were two meetings, the one meeting with Rouhani, and he was excluded from that meeting. And Soleimani wasn't in that meeting. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the president is actually failing to invite his foreign minister to a meeting, and he wasn't replaced by anyone else. And that is totally unacceptable. And it was that particular meeting that he objected to more than anything else. And as I said, and what Soleimani said very clearly, immediately as this incident happened, he said that Zarif enjoys the highest level of support in the highest level. And indeed, what he meant was Ayatollah Khamenei. I mean, it really is exceptionally is known that he's been exceptionally supported as a foreign minister. And so I don't think there was any sort of issue at that particular meeting. I think there was more concern overall, and in particular, the meeting with Mr. President.
Masoud, Hillary Clinton, when she was still a senator and sitting on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, famously said that Iran was not a theocracy. It was a military dictatorship. Did she have a point? Was she right? And is that why we're seeing this dichotomy inside the government today?
Not really. I mean, what is really very clear within the situation of Iran is that there is not a dictatorship of any sort. There are genuine power sharing. Enjoyed in Iran. And this is why, in some way, it's very difficult to make a decision. It's not like Saudi Arabia that the king or the prince, while having a cup of tea, decides a policy, and that policy becomes the policy of the country. The reality is that the judiciary, the armed forces, the government, and indeed Belayat Faqih and his office all have got constitutional power. And there has to be consensus among all this. And the reality is, as I said, very, very clearly, according to the constitution of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei actually has got the power over the foreign policy. But nevertheless, we have seen very clearly a go-ahead to Zarif and to Rouhani government to go and negotiate the nuclear deal, even though we heard even at the beginning of this process, in the middle of it, and then afterward, on all these stages, we heard from Ayatollah Khamenei saying that he doesn't trust the process. He doesn't trust United States, and United States cannot be trusted. And he's proven to be right. But nevertheless, he actually endorsed the process So really what we are seeing is much more sophisticated, much more policy-making structure within Iran. And I think, it is really wrong to think that, one group or one section has got authoritarian and dictatorial power in Iran that could do whatever they want, or indeed does whatever they want.
Zarif is in the middle of a number of very important foreign policy initiatives, and the most important one is related to what you were talking about in terms of the negotiations to save the nuclear deal, and that's the creation of a special financial vehicle, right, that would be administered by the European signatories to the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and would be used to essentially circumvent the new sanctions that have been imposed on Iran by the United States. What's the status of that? Is that vehicle functional? Do you think it's going to be enough?
Unfortunately, it doesn't look very good. And indeed, if you listen to what Zarif been saying in recent days and weeks, is that he's saying that he's very concerned that this policy and the way that has been supported by the European was coming to a situation that is going to be rejected by people in Iran. I mean, people in Iran are looking at this and saying, what have we got out of this? And the reality is, up to now, up to this latest hour, you can't really justify this. Yes, we had many promises from the European nation and others, including China and Russia. But the reality is that in practice, things haven't moved forward at all. And if it doesn't, it was going to come to a stage, as Zarif highlighting over and over, that people will lose confidence in it. And once people lose confidence in it, then it can't really move forward. It was dead. If Iranians feel that way, then it's going to die. And I think that is actually a very important statement and is it really highlighting a reality.
Masoud, we are going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Istanbul by Masoud Shajara. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear. Ah.